I'll try and answer the questions more quickly tonight, otherwise we'll be in big trouble. Dear Ajahn, question number one. Ajahn Chah said the noise doesn't disturb you, you disturb the noise. Why didn't you follow this advice when the trucks made noise passing the monastery? Instead, you lost $100,000 approximately and every court case, but we won the battle. The truck stopped. It wasn't the noise was the main actually reason why we fought that. It was the safety. For those of you who know, we fought these truck cases, past our monastery, and what was the straw which made me really take it on was when I saw one of the trucks turn over on Kingsbury Drive going downhill, lost control, and the only thing they could do was actually they drove into the side of the bank, turned themselves over the side, and actually scraping the truck along the road was the only way they could actually stop. Because I didn't know this, but sometime before, one of the trucks had not been able to stop on that hill down from our monastery and careered over Kingsbury, over the Southwest Highway, and got into the fence on the other side. So it was a danger, not the noise. And that was actually my duty of care. Because I didn't want any of either my monks or any of the people coming out to the monastery to actually end up under a truck. Not noise, but safety. Ajahn, last night you told a story about the guy, Jyoti Pala's friend, the potter, who didn't want to dig earth for the fear of killing worms. Do we really create bad karma if we kill a living being unintentionally, such as walking on ants? You don't create bad karma unless you deliberately look for the ants and choose that path, go stepping on them. The point is, it's intentional. And as far as karma is concerned, it's only if you deliberately kill a living being. And this is a good point made by the commentary. The bigger the living being, the more bad karma it is, simply because the more intention you have to exert to destroy that being's life. So there is a lot of difference, and you can feel this if you swat a mosquito or if you kill an elephant. You know, you can't just swat an elephant. You know, you have to really sort of want to kill it before you can kill an elephant. But a mosquito can be just one little thought, just a lapse of mindfulness. So you can understand why it's much more karma to kill the bigger beings than the smaller ones. So it's not just good karma and bad karma, there's all sorts of greys in between. And so here we're saying that killing ants, if you deliberately step on one, that's bad karma. It's not as bad karma as if you know you kill your husband. Quite obviously. And for Gatikara, remember, this was such a pure being. And he knew it was not bad karma if he dug the earth. He had no intention of killing the worms, but he was just being kind. He wasn't talking about karma here, he was talking about compassion. So even if it's no bad karma, if you sort of, you know, on the path that you step on a snail, so you're not making bad karma there, but you're not being compassionate if you don't look out for them. So it's something more than just keeping good, avoiding bad karma. It's making good karma. So that's what Gatikara the potter, even if, you know, he wasn't going to be born again, it didn't really matter about karma for him. But what he was saying is just like compassion for living beings. So see if I can avoid killing those little worms or other things in the soil, because he could actually get the earth from another source. Is that okay? Okay, next question. Ajahn, could you please clarify if jhana 1, 2, 3, 4 is the same as spring when he wants to return, etc.? No, the jhanas are one thing. There's sort of deep states of mind. It's an interesting question because sometimes people get those experiences. They're so powerful, so wonderful, that sometimes people think, wow, we're enlightened now. But you're not enlightened. You still get angry afterwards and you still get upset. You still have your fears, etc. But, you know, they're close. And actually, they're so close, not only did the Buddha call the happiness of these jhanas, like Sambodhi Sukha, like enlightenment happiness, but he also called it like Nibbana in this life, in this existence. That was also one of the Buddha's quotes. He called jhana Nibbana in this existence, in this life. It's not Nibbana, but it's close enough, on your doorway to the Nibbana, but it's not the same. So it's not stream winner, stream entry, but I'll talk about the jhanas and nimittas tomorrow in greater length at the morning talk. That's coming soon in a theatre near you. Another question is radiating metta to all beings, especially those in the hell realm, can they receive our metta? actually they say in the hell realm they can't, because they're so basically they won't receive, they don't want to receive it. Have you ever like tried to spread a message with someone, they just refuse to receive it? And why is that? Because they don't think they deserve their metta. A question someone asked me about a year ago, and it was a lovely question because it opened up a lot of insights. Is there a hell realm in Buddhism? Do we believe in hell? And the answer is yes, in the suttas there is a hell. Then why do you go down there? Who sent you down there? That's not very compassionate. Surely the Buddha would clean up hell for a long time ago. Or closed it down. Put a sort of out of use order on it. So, how, and if you read some of the traditions, in the Sri Lanka, Thai, they say it's like the Yama gods. They judge you after you die, and they look and see what you were doing, and they know everything. So they've got CCTV cameras, you know, in your mind, so know exactly what you're thinking. And it never made any sense to me that these were supposed to be high beings. Who would send anybody down to hell? I couldn't do that. So it got quite clear to me that the person who sends you down to hell is you. You send yourself down to hell, and at that time you create with the mental faculties, the Yama gods, you judge yourself and you decide what punishment you need. And actually you make the hell to suit yourself. What you think you deserve, that's what you get. Which is a fascinating piece of psychology. And exactly what happens, that you punish yourself, you forgive yourself. But when it comes to radiating loving kindness to enemies, sometimes people just will not forgive themselves. And no matter how kind you are, no matter how you say, let go, forgive yourself, it's a small thing, they will not do it. Basically, they refuse to receive the metta. There's nothing you can do. So the beings in hell will not receive your loving kindness because they think they don't deserve it. Strange thing that. And it's a very sad thing as well. Because sometimes you can give your loving kindness to yourself now and forgive your faults. But can you do that? Sometimes you can't because you think you don't deserve to be forgiven. So if you can't give loving kindness to yourself right now, how can you give it to hell beings? They just don't think they deserve it. And that's the biggest problem. It's nothing which is in nature, it's in you. You create your nature, you create your world. You create heavens and hells. That's why if you want to go to heaven and realm, you actually create the one which you think you want. If I go to heaven, it'll be Jimi Hendrix there. None of this harp music. And there won't be ambrosia in my heaven, it'll be fish and chips. Or whatever else you like. If you should be like you, don't go to my heaven. You know, you have poppers every morning. Or whatever else you like. So, this is actually what happens, you know. And you create that, because it's all mind-made. How's that? Is that okay? About hell realms that can't receive love and kindness, because basically that they don't want to. Any questions on that? Yes. You know.
We're determining what our future will be.
Yeah.
In hell, I think
they believe that superficially. But after you die, there's a huge clarity of mind comes up. And you know, you realize you've done something really, really bad. So I think there's like a huge amount of remorse comes up. What the hell have I done? And I think at that time, they'd probably go to a hell realm afterwards. You know, when they sort of experience and see all the pain they've caused. So those superficial beliefs, you know, they're only just that, they're just like a packaging on the outside of something much deeper. And at the time of death, there's a huge amount of clarity comes. And they'll see that they've done something terrible. But, you know, if you've had a religion of hate, a religion of punishment, a religion of sort of an angry God, then of course, you know, you will have heavens, you will have lots of hells. If you have a religion of forgiveness, then there'll be hardly be anyone in the hell realm. So you people here, because you know, I've been encouraging forgiveness for such a long time, you know, you're really emptying out the hells by not sending anybody down there. And that's why the stream winner You know, if you see that there's no self in there, then only then you can understand what forgiveness is. You don't need to be punished. A lot of the idea of punishment is conceit, of a sense of self. It's not good enough, so you've got to sort it out and punish it. When you see it's just this empty process, it's cause and effect. There's no one to be punished. There's no one to be blamed. It's, again, none of your business, this blaming and punishing. So that way that once you become like a stream winner, you see that very clearly, you never go to a hell realm ever again. The hell realms are closed for you when you're a stream winner. I always wondered exactly why that was. That's part of Buddhism. A stream winner never gets to a lower realm. But why? And that's the answer. Next question. Mahayana tradition emphasized on the Bodhisattva way. What does Theravada tradition say about it? Okay, Mahayana. The idea of the Bodhisattva is you're going to sacrifice your enlightenment for all other beings. When somebody is sitting here, if it's too hot, you get a fan out and you fan them. There's a little mosquito going to land on them. You took it away and say to the mosquito, you bite me instead. You sacrifice your enlightenment for the sake of other beings. That's the idea. And in Theravada, you're supposed to, or Hinayana they say, you're supposed to just be concerned about your own enlightenment and you don't give a damn about other people. Now, of course, that is just a theory which has no relation to reality at all. There is no Mahayana, there is no Hinayana, just like there's no Samatha, there's no Vipassana, there's no Mahayana, there's no Theravada. That was just an invention of some monks who should have been sitting more and get the nose out of the books more. So, you know, too much study, too much thinking, too much arguing, too much discrimination and judging, not enough practice. Because the point is that both of those attitudes are completely wrong. You can't think of yourself, nor can you just think of others. Now, you count as well. If you're one of these very compassionate people, compassion also has to go to you. And you can see that anyone who gets enlightened, whether it's an Ajahn Chah, whether it's a Buddha, they're incredibly compassionate people, not just afterwards, but before as well. The point is, it's not about me, it's not about you, it's all about us. Meditation, like anything else, is a relationship. If you just think about, you know, this one who's watching, and not concerned about what you're experiencing, or you're just concerned about what you're experiencing and not who's watching, both of those, you never get anywhere in the meditation. The place where you get a lot of traction in meditation is the place in between. It's your relationship to what you're experiencing. It's not the sloth and torpor, it's not the nimitta. It's how you're relating to that. With peace, with letting go, with stillness. And that's where Buddhism is. In the middle. Between me and the other. Between the observer and the observed. And that's why it's called the middle way. So, the difference between Mahayana and Hinayana is just a philosophical, theoretical division. And people like to sort of think that I am Theravada. You know, I'm into my own enlightenment. And you see Theravada monks. And, you know, sometimes I go to these conferences overseas. For example, this last conference, last June, Dr. Yifa, you know, she's from the Fo Kwang Shan group, Mahayana. And I had to see her just before she left, so I went down to the temple in Guildford Road. And you know, she gave me a cup of tea, we were talking, and she said, I don't have any disciples, they're too much trouble. And I said, I have heaps of disciples. He said, you're Hinayana, I'm the Mahayana one. Because actually, I look much more Mahayana than anybody else. And the point is that a lot of times in Buddhism, we have this conceited Buddhism. I've got the best teacher. Who's your teacher? Ah, that guy, they're hopeless. You should come to our teacher. Our teacher's the best. Well, we've got the best vehicle. And sometimes I'm reading some of these magazines and it's really, really gross. They say there's like, you know, first of all they said there were three vehicles. There's the, you know, Theravada, like we're the dummies. And then the Mahayana is the more intelligent people who came much later on. You know, at the time of the Buddha there's just dummies born, and that's us. But you know, afterwards there's other very important suttas were revealed because people couldn't understand them at that time, and this is for the intelligent. And then later on, the third turning of the wheel, the Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhists, and that's for the super intelligent. That's just conceit. You know, we've got the best vehicle. And apparently I was reading this, and they said, no, it's not three vehicles, it's actually nine vehicles. I don't know what they get that from, but they said nine. But now there's a tenth. The fourth turning of the wheel is Dogchen. And that's the superior, most extremely best. And when I read that, and actually I was reading that in the book, and I thought, gee, I mean, that whoever wrote that is just super conceited. I don't know how they can get away with that in this world. Can't people see that, you know, I'm the best of the best? That's ego. That's nothing to do with Buddhism at all. So any one of you say, we've got the best teachings, and you guys over there, you know, you're just messing around. That's just conceit and ego. So, you know the old joke. Big vehicle, small vehicle, all vehicles will be towed away at the owner's expense. This is a very nice say. So that's actually what we think of. Anyone want to say anything about that? Okay. Because no one owns compassion, no one owns enlightenment. No Buddhist tradition has got the franchise on compassion and say, we're the compassionate ones, you guys are the selfish ones. Because you just actually look, that doesn't fit the reality on the ground. So whether it's Theravada or Mahayana or Vajrayana, we're just all doing the same. You know, supporting hospitals and hospices and orphanages, really going out, busting our guts to try and teach the Dharma and help people. We're all doing that and we're all meditating. We're all sort of writing books, spreading Buddhism, trying to help out, trying to create a more peaceful world. So whether you're Theravada, whether you're Mahayana, whether you're Vajrayana, we're all doing the same. We actually see that. Alas, you know, the people actually know. The actual practitioners, we all become friends. They just wear different colour robes, that's all. But actually the traditions, the heart of them are the same. So never be conceited about your tradition. The Buddha would not really recommend that at all. Oh, this is a question from yesterday. Did the Buddha say to the monks not to eat meat if they know it's being prepared for them? Nowadays, when people bring down to the monastery, how could monks deny that it wasn't specially prepared for them? In reality, that's what people do something best and give best dana. Compared to early days when they went begging for food, they got leftovers. What were that household I had, and so it was okay to eat frogs and bats because that's all they had. Okay, it's what the Buddha actually said here, if it's killed especially for you. And that actually happened, or almost happened, in my first year in this monastery. No, actually it's just over a year and a half I've been in Thailand. And it was in this monastery in the northeast of Thailand, that's where you did eat this gross food, you know, whatever crawl, that's what you ate. And it was crawly things, you know, I told you about the frogs and the snails, which you had to eat, and the ants' eggs, and all this other gross stuff, which, you know, was in our bowl every day. But just about 2 weeks before Christmas, this American turned up at our monastery. He was married to a Thai. And because he was married to a Thai, and, you know, these were Western monks, you know, he actually came to say hello. And when we were talking to him, he said, what are you doing here? It's actually that in a village, he was raising turkeys. And it was 2 weeks before Christmas, and he said, do you want a turkey for Christmas? And straight away, as a young monk, I thought, that's much more delicious than frogs. Hey, I'm going to get a Christmas dinner. Wow, marvellous. And then he said, I'll choose one especially for you and kill it. Oh no, why do you have to say that? Because that meant that we couldn't take it, we had to say no, because he was going to kill it especially for us. If one had been already killed for sale, just one of many, we'd have been allowed. But if it was killed especially for you, then that is prohibited. So if it's brought, if it's prepared specially, that's okay, but if it's killed specially for you, then you can't take it. That's where the Buddha drew the line. And in your food fair, how many chickens and pigs and frogs? Is that frogs? I don't know. Etc. are going to die. How come you are turning a blind eye to this? I've got a blind eye. My eyes are perfectly good. Again, this is what the Buddha said. If it's food, which is the normal food which people eat, you know, then it can be allowed to be eaten by the monks, because the monks can eat it. Now, how can we actually say no to other people eating it? So as long as it hasn't been killed especially, so we won't sort of have like a lobster attack at our food fair and say, choose your lobster, because that's really gross. So whatever actually has been already got from the market, then that is okay as far as the monks are concerned, and it's okay for our food fair as well. And last, why did you encourage people to become vegetarians? This is not a criticism, but a genuine question. You try and encourage if it's at all possible, but sometimes, you know, it's not possible for people to become vegetarians. I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, and one of the experiences which showed that at that time I was a fundamentalist vegetarian, because whenever you went past a butcher's shop, you'd actually have to cross the road to the other side. And my mother, you know, I was staying with her for that time, and she would cook meat, and there's only a certain amount of frying pans or whatever, and so I had to scrub that frying pan 3 or 4 times before I deigned to use it for my veggie burger. And then once I went to my girlfriend's house for dinner, and you know, she, you know, really went out of her way to try and cook me a meal, and I don't know how she forgot I was a vegetarian. She should have known, but she cooked me a meat meal and I refused to eat it, and I really upset her. And nowadays, when I look at that, I thought, you know, you were just really, you know, stuffed up in your head, Ajahn Brahm, at that time. Because I was kind to animals, but I was very cruel to people. And that's one of the troubles if you're a fundamentalist vegetarian. The point is, in our life, that we will always be destroying animals, little beings. Even just when you came here in your car, you know, there's many little beings, bugs, were smashed against your windscreen. Even though you do try and avoid the animals when you walk outside, you'll always be killing some. Even just when you eat a carrot, that carrot has been planted in the earth, been pulled out afterwards. And much of that process of growing even vegetables, animals have to die. So instead of being a fundamentalist, what we try and do is to lessen as much as possible our harm on the natural environment. To lessen it as much as possible. But you can't sort of prevent harming altogether. You have to try and limit it as much as possible. So that's our standard there, to limit it. Ajahn, going into blissful states of the mind and forgetting the deep wounds in the heart, is it like putting a bandage over a wound? Please explain. No, because many of the wounds in your heart become healed when you leave them alone. Now these, if you have a wound, on say on your arm, what does the doctor do? He usually bandages up, cleans it, bandages it, and just leaves it alone, because the body heals the wounds itself. And the thing is, you've just got to try and isolate it, protect it, because it will heal itself. In the same way the mind gets into deep states by itself, your job is just to protect it and nurture it. But I remember once having a little cut, and so I put a plaster on it, and I thought, that's no good, so I took the plaster off and put some ointment on it, and put it back on again, and maybe that's the wrong ointment, so I opened it up again, took that ointment on, put some new ointment on, then closed it up again, that might be not the right ointment, maybe the first ointment was good enough. And I kept on interfering with it, it took a long time before it healed. And you all know that sometimes what we do with our meditation, we're always interfering. Now do metta meditation. No, that's not right. Take the metta meditation off, and now we'll do sort of mantra meditation. This is good enough. No, that's not good enough. We'll take that off, and maybe we'll do sort of anapana. And we're always messing up instead of allowing the wounds to heal. What jhana does, it gives you stillness. And in that stillness, it's amazing, just you are getting out of the way, and the body and even the emotions heal themselves. Simply because you are still. Energies go through the body, and instead of being blocked up. This is a common occurrence. No one's actually asked this yet, quite surprising. Sometimes when you're getting still in meditation, you get some weird feelings in your body, hot spots or jerks or whatever. Or you just lean over in a very, very strange posture. And it just happens naturally. And people say, what's going on there? I never did that. Why? What happens is when you really get still, the energies of the body, where you call them the winds going through your body, which is the Indian tradition, or sort of the qi, which is the Chinese description, they are now flowing freely. They're not blocked up anymore. And because they're not blocked up, because you're really relaxing, sometimes those energies, they go to a place in your body which really needs it. I think it was last year, I think, here, one of the ladies in the interview room said, really weird, I was sitting there quite peaceful, but my whole of the back and shoulders got really hot. What's going on? And I said, have you had an injury in your back? She said, how did you know? What do you mean, how did I know? You just told me. Because, you know, a year or two before, she had some car accident, she had some whiplash, and the whole back and neck were injured, and this was a healing going on. She felt really good afterwards. The thing is, you need to relax, first of all, for that natural healing energy to flow. So that's what sometimes happens. And not only just the physical wounds, but also the emotional ones as well, because a lot of times emotional stuff is emotional blockages. And when you get into these jhanas, your mind is completely freed. And so afterwards you see it in a completely different light. You break that old habit, the one way of looking at things. You can see it from another angle. When you see it from another angle, you say, what's the big deal? And then it's free. So the jhanas are great ways of healing the body and solving other problems. Okay, the nimitta one, that's coming tomorrow. I'll just do it quickly. Is nimitta a mind-created object? And the answer is that nimittas are reflections of the mind. So it's not so much a created object, but it's the mind being seen, but what you create is the colours of it. So whether it's yellow, blue, white or whatever, that's what you add to it, that's what you create. But there's something there which is real. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow. And when seated, should the eyes be closed all the time? No, it's good to keep the eyes open when you get up. But rest of the time, keep them closed. Eventually, finally, ideally, we meditate all the time. No, you don't meditate all the time. Sometimes you've got to answer questions, you've got to talk, sometimes you've got to eat. So, sometimes what happens if you do walking meditation and you cross the road, left foot moving, right foot moving, you're going to get run over. It's the same as when you go home and you start watching the breath when you're in your car, you're going to have an accident. So you don't meditate all the time. What you do is whatever the task at hand, you give it everything you've got. So it can be present moment awareness a lot of the time, except when you're planning what you're going to do next, which you have to do in life. So in other words, keep it natural. So let go a lot and do the minimum of controlling for a happy life. If at all possible, be irresponsible. Because you guys are far too responsible. You take on all these burdens and you try and control your world and you usually mess it up no end. That's what happens when you're so damn responsible. So responsible irresponsibility. I mean, be like a little kid every now and again, enjoying yourself and having no worries and concerns. Why do you carry all those responsibilities around with you? You really think you're indispensable. But you're not. Sooner or later you're going to die. And your business, your family are going to go quite well without you. Even you've been away for a week. And probably your family are even happier than they were when you were there. So you can let go more. Any comments about those last couple of questions? Okay, I'm going through them quickly. When one is concentrated to a certain extent, please explain how to go deep into concentration. You don't go, you stay. And then you become deep in concentration. You don't go anywhere. Stay where you are. Stay put. Stop. So the more you stop, the more concentration deepens. So, okay, now that was not just a joke, because, you know, the way we actually write those questions, the way we look at the whole process, and we go here, we go there, just into, stay where you are, stay put, let go. I think one of the suttas, it says, you know, the Buddha says, when will there be an end of all this coming and going? Now, when will there be an end of all your coming and going? So where? No, not death. No, you still go off to hell realms, or you go to heaven realms. You're still coming and going. That's when you're really still in deep meditation. You're not going anywhere. You're just being still. You're not coming anywhere. You're already here. So see if you can put an end to all the coming and going. You've just been journeying all your life, like going on this long, long, long journey. And now I'm inviting you to sit down and rest. And what you do, as soon as you start sitting down and rest, you get up and go somewhere else. Where are you going now? I'm going to jhanas. Shut up, sit down and rest. Ajahn, you said, metta, loving kindness to body, is hard. Sometimes I do loving kindness to each part of the body and notice the thought association to each part. And there is always negativity and some strong negative thought association, but I found loving kindness of my old middle-aged emotional face to be very beneficial. It opened up a whole new world of good self-worth, gladness, and it's fun to do when at work passing mirrors. I picked up this practice while meditating on Anamara, hearing talks there. That's okay, you can do loving kindness to your face, because you're stuck with it. Actually, you can get actually face transplants now. No, they're starting to do those in, because I don't think you guys can afford it anyway, so it's a waste of time. You might as well be happy with the one you've got. You can do loving kindness to this old, wrinkled, old face. Which means you save a lot on Botox and all this other stuff. So it's great, sort of, you know, being who you are and not having to worry about all these things. So yeah, it's good, but when I think loving kindness to the body, I thought I said it's hearted loving kindness towards yourself, you know, to who you think you are. Again, because we've got so much negativity and guilt in our lives, we don't forgive ourselves. And so I think I meant loving kindness towards, you know, oneself, not one's body. But yeah, it's great to do loving kindness towards this body, because this body is like this vehicle which has been so kind to you, and it's carried you around this world so many years. And, you know, you've abused it so much, and it's still breathing, which is a miracle. So thank you, body. You may not be the best body, but at least you're good enough to bring me to this retreat. So be kind to your body for that much. And even if you're very, very sick, I mean, your body is doing a wonderful service to all these doctors, giving you some more stuff to do tests on. So anyway, your body's okay. Dajan, it seems that like loving kindness includes compassion, e.g. towards a little kitten. Does Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion, symbolizing loving kindness in Buddhism? Yeah, these images, you know, Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion, that can symbolize whatever you want. And it's amazing just how Kuan Yin has changed. That's the one god in Buddhism which has had a sex change, as many people know, because if you see the old statues of Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara was a male. But nowadays, it's a female. It's the one god who's had a sex change. But Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, actually met, I don't know how many of you know this, it was supposed to be one of the chief disciples, this is how it started off, the chief disciples of Maitreya. Oh no, was it Amitabha? I think it was Amitabha, I think. Yeah. One of the chief disciples of Amitabha, because they say that every Buddha has two chief disciples. So we have our Buddha, Sakyamuni. Who was his two chief disciples? This is your question tonight. Who was chief disciple number one? Sariputta. And who's number two? Moggallana, yeah. So who were the two chief disciples of Amitabha? One was Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara. Who was number two? It's a very well-known name. In fact, you know, you all know a certain person in Perth by that name. No, not Prabhupada. Okay, that's close. You are getting very, very hot. It's another Ajahn who lives with the ladies, Wayama. That was actually the other chief disciple of Amitabha, Avalokiteshvara and Wayama. Avalokiteshvara is like, you know, a symbol of compassion. Wayama is a symbol of effort. And of those two, people forgot about effort. That was not popular, but compassion certainly was. And so Wayama got completely forgotten. And Avalokiteshvara got elevated to like a goddess in their own right. It was actually supposed to be just a disciple of the Buddha. Fascinating how history actually changes, how we make these images, you know, what we want. So anyway, that's the history of Kuan Yin. But yeah, what was actually the question? Oh, compassion, yeah. Yeah, these images, whatever you want to make them. For example, what does the Buddha statue behind me symbolize? When you bow to the Buddha, what did you bow to? A lump of metal. What are you doing that for? So when I bow to a Buddha, it's not the statue, it's what it symbolizes. So for me, the Buddha symbolizes, I would say, Sila Samadhi Panya, the virtue, the peace, and the wisdom. But sometimes I change wisdom for compassion. So, you know, virtue, peace, and compassion. So when I bow down first time, I bow down to peace. Bow down first time to virtue. Then I bow down to peace. Then I bow down to compassion. So that's what I'm worshipping. I'm not worshipping a lump of metal. I'm worshipping virtue, peace, and compassion. And you find if you remember what you're doing when you bow down, you're mindful of what it means. And you bow down every day, many times, to virtue, peace, and compassion. You're reminding yourself how worthy those things are, how important they are, which means that those qualities grow in you. So that's actually why we bow. Yes.
When I thought about that in Mahasheng Panya, I thought the peace and compassion are the same.
Though it's compassion leads to peace, but they're all sort of interlinked, intertwined. I would actually put compassion with the wisdom. Yeah, that's good. So whatever these you want to make that image, you can actually make it like forgiveness, if you like, to bow to forgiveness. To bow to whatever else it is that thing symbolizes for you. And then it's doing it properly. So a Kuan Yin is what it means to you. And if it's a symbol of compassion or a symbol of metta, then fine. Then bow to that. But remember what you're bowing to. And then the image has got a meaning for you. And so often, like Kuan Yin, a symbol of compassion, or loving kindness if you want, and if you sort of worship that, it doesn't matter if you're Theravada or if you're Christian or whatever, if you worship that, you're worshipping compassion. And what's wrong with that? Of course it works. It's very helpful. It's a skillful means. Because you become more compassionate.
I think of the Buddha.
Yeah. Very good. You can do that. Whatever it is you do, but make sure you're not just bowing down just out of habit. I made this joke a few days ago. People who prostrate too much without mindfulness. You know what the karma is of prostrating too much without mindfulness? You get prostate cancer. Okay, so that's not a very good joke, but nevertheless. Dear Ajahn, it seems that, like, loving kind. Oh, yeah, I did that one already. Next one. Dear Ajahn, how do you know that the sutras you read are actually the word of the Buddha? During the Buddha's time, there was no writing, and the recitations of the teaching may have changed through the centuries. That's a very good question, that there's very, very, very strong arguments. Because it's a question people have asked, how do you know? And there is a means of knowing. And one of those means of knowing is that when Buddhism went to different regions, then it was geographically separated. They didn't have too much contact between each other. So you can imagine that some things were added in the different locations. But what is common to all those traditions, you think must have been there before Buddhism spread apart. Because it's almost just too much of a coincidence that two different regions would have added exactly the same thing. So what we're trying to do is to find out what's common to all the traditions. And now, as I think I said the other day, that the Chinese tradition, which again is a very early tradition because they took many of the suttas over to China, and the nice thing about the Chinese tradition is they translated word for word, and they had an ideogram for every different Sanskrit word or Pali word, which means it is pretty simple to retranslate the Chinese back into Pali or Sanskrit. And many of the monks have been doing this, and they get very interesting discoveries. And, for example, one of those discoveries is Satipatthana Sutta. In the Chinese version, in the fourth Satipatthana, the only two parts of the Dhammanusati are the five hindrances and seven enlightenment factors. Everything else is absent. In the Pali tradition, Four Noble Truths are there. What else is there? Five Khandhas is there. I think Six Sense Bases is there. It's quite clear that that has been added. It's okay to add it. It doesn't make it wrong, but it's not what the Buddha originally said in the Satipatthana Sutta. That's just one example. There's many other really interesting examples. I've mentioned, I think, another one where we had the Mahacitarasaka Sutta. They had like the super mundane right view, an ordinary right view. That is not there in the Chinese. That has also been added in the Pali tradition. You've got Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is clearly added. There is no Abhidhamma in the time of the Buddha. There is just the suttas and the Vinaya. And that is all. That is very clear. So we can actually challenge all of our traditions to find out what's early. We can take it back very, very early to maybe one or 200 years after the time of the Buddha. And we're certain that that was Buddhism at that time. This was before it was written down, or when it started to be written down. To take it earlier and to see, was this actually what the Buddha said? Then what we can do then is actually to start contemplating when you had like a unified group of monks, how could they have changed those teachings? You can't change those teachings deliberately. It's very hard to do. And the reason is because there was no hierarchy. There was something very interesting happened about 100 years after the time of the Buddha's passing away. Around the city of Vaisali, just north of Patna, the monks there decided, well, times have changed. In the time of the Buddha, yeah, you could get around without having money, but this is a modern world, talking about 2400 years ago. Monks need money these days. And so the monks around Vaisali started to accept money. When other monks heard about this, they said, you can't do this, this is against the rules. They said, yes, we can. They're actually trying to change, not so much the teachings, but the Vinaya. And what happened was all the other monks, they came around, they ganged up on these group of monks accepting money, and they had this big, a conference, this big meeting. And at the meeting, they decided, no, you can't change anything, this is what's laid down by the Buddha, you have got no right to change anything. And they couldn't do it. The only way you could have changed those teachings was if you had some sort of pope and hierarchy which could order it from the top down. Because there was no hierarchy, there was no mechanism to change those teachings deliberately. But what would have happened, there would have been the possibility of some little errors in recitation or some what we call these days typos. But the other thing we know is there's so many repetitions in those suttas It's not just a small amount of information. That information is repeated and repeated and repeated over and over and over and over again. And there's a consistency there. So you see, like, say, Satipatthana Sutta, that's in the Majjhima Nikaya, but it's also in the Digha Nikaya, it's also a Satipatthana Samyutta. And it all fits together. It's not inconsistent. And so because you've got a huge amount of information there, and it's repeated again and again and again, it's very hard to say that something's been added or changed. So I think that really if you use like reason, not wishful thinking but reason, it's pretty easy to find out what the Buddha actually taught. The Pali Suttas are close but they're not perfect. And if we join the Pali Suttas and the Chinese Agama together and compare the two and get what's common to both, we're getting very, very close. And what you find there is Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, three characteristics of existence, five khandhas, all the basic teachings, you know, which you already know. Yes, Shirat.
Are there monks who remember it?
Sometimes there are, yes, but they're very few and far between. I don't know that the one which comes to mind is, you may have seen in a documentary, I think it was actually even the BBC managed to put them, these two, or one of the two young boys who were reborn, they must be about 40 now, and they could remember all this old chanting. And they were spontaneously chanting when they were very, very young. There's no way they could have learned that. They said they remembered it from a previous life about 1500 years ago when they learnt the chanting. And, you know, I've got a tape of those chants in my room. And it's the hair on the back of your head rises up when you hear this little boy, must have been about 6 or 7 years of age, chanting some of these chants such as the Anattalakkhana Sutta or the Ratana Sutta. Because where he does not chant it the way you chant it in Sri Lanka, there's no Namo Tassa. It's always Namo Tassa. His pronunciation is untraditional. But what we can say is that that must have been how that was chanted 1500 years ago. And it's perfect chanting. And I compared it with what's in the suttas. And it's 100% the same. So actually there is actually a little boy, only 6 or 7 years of age I think when he started this. And he could spontaneously chant these suttas and perfect pronunciation and exactly the same as you see in the books today. I believe so, yeah. But, you know, before he forgot it, because it was in our modern age, they had actually, I think, videoed him and he recorded it. He got his all recorded, this little young boy chanting. It was very, very inspiring. Yeah. No, because it's completely different than Sri Lankan chanting. So that's fascinating, that. Yeah? Abhidharma originally meant sort of the deeper teachings of the meditation of Dhamma. It did not mean a philosophical treatise. For example, there's one sutta, the Gudisana Sutta, where it's all about a forest monk and the duties of a forest monk. One of the things they say, like a forest monk should know much more about Abhidharma and Abhivinaya than a city monk. Now, if Abhidharma meant just these books which you have to learn, it's the city monks do all the learning, the forest monks do all the meditating. And it's quite clear from that, in the time of the Buddha, the Abhidharma means a deeper understanding which you get from your experiences of meditation, where the forest monks excel in Abhidharma, not the city monks. So it's something which the forest monks excel in. And that actually shows you what Abhidharma originally meant. In the first council, after the Buddha passed away and the monks recited all these suttas together, there's no record of any recitation of Abhidharma. There, Ananda recited the five Nikayas, the Panchanikaya, which is Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and Kudaka Nikaya, what we have today. no Abhidhamma. And even the texts actually say, the Buddha taught Abhidhamma to his mother in the Tusita realm, and then afterwards it was kept up there until much later. In other words, it didn't exist. So if it was taught up in the heavenly realm or in the Naga realm, and then later on revealed, that's an admission that it wasn't actually there, it was hidden, it was somewhere else. As an explanation, it somehow appeared, and he said, oh no, it was actually from the time of the Buddha, but you know, that you didn't know that before.
My understanding is that it was written by Dhammacharya.
That Buddha Ghosa actually wrote the commentaries. The Abhidhamma was there before, and every different geographical location has different Abhidhammas, and that's actually the Abhidhamma is what they argued over most of all. And it was that philosophy, and anyone who knows anything about Buddhism, and if you start meditating, that's just so much proliferation, far too many concepts, you're wasting your time, you're thinking too much. And that's where all that philosophy comes from.
So it's like other revelations?
Yeah, it's like other revelations, and actually it complicates Buddhism. It takes it a long way away from the ordinary people. You have to be a doctor of philosophy to understand a lot of that. And it means that the priests become the power sources, because you have to study for years and years to be able to know the Abhidhamma, instead of actually the Buddhism becoming just a part of the people as well. So, you know, you can understand suttas, you can read those, you can meditate, but if you try learning the Abhidhamma, you have to have some expert, and the expert was the priest. Yeah?
Is there any discussion of the university at Nalanda? There's a big movement in Singapore.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
I think it was created by the Indian Prime Minister.
Yeah, yeah.
They want to, they call for funds to resurrect the old university.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of scholars are now involved in laying the groundwork to, you know, bring back the manuscripts and
it's a waste of time. There's enough universities already. There's plenty of universities, there's not enough people meditating. So they use all that money to have a really good meditation monastery. I support that. But no, it's too many universities. We're always building, every country's got more universities. There's so many professors around. Okay, that's my rant on Abhidhamma. Is it correct to say that the knower and the doer are two distinct functions of one single mind? And if so, the aim of Buddhist practice is to develop a stage when the doer function can be turned off completely while allowing the knower to function fully. Very nice question. These are two aspects of the mind, but when you have aspects, we don't make them absolutes. It's just a convenient way for the purpose of this meditation of dividing the mind into two things. There's other convenient ways. We've kind of got the five khandhas. We have the body, and then you have the four mental khandhas of like feeling. That's the pleasure and pain of all the five, six senses, sorry. And you have the perception, you have the mental formations, which is centered on will, and consciousness. That's another way of looking at it. Or you have the six senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing. But it doesn't really matter actually what, you know, how you divide these things. Here we're just dividing it in the knower and the doer, because that's really helpful for understanding meditation. In meditation, you are letting go, suppressing the doer first of all. Until you're not doing anything, it's letting go, no controller. And if you let go of the doer, you get into the jhanas. And once you're in the jhanas, you start letting go of the knower. In other words, consciousness starts to fade away. And that's weird, and I'll be talking about that tomorrow, when you get to such stages of neither perception or non-perception. What the hell does that mean? It means that the consciousness is almost completely disappeared. That what you're experiencing, there's nothing, absolutely nothing there, no perception, but you're perceiving no perception. So on one end, yeah, there is a mind. On the other end, it's completely stopped. So to understand this, you have to have these experiences to really understand what's going on. But that's actually what's happening. Because you find that those are the two places where you think you exist. I am the one who does. I am the one in charge. I have my own responsibility. I'm the one who decides what I do. No one else can tell me. I decided to come here. I decide when to go to bed. I decide whether to scratch my nose or not to scratch it. And that is your delusion. You think that you're in charge of you. And the other delusion is you think you're behind this knower. That you are the consciousness, the knowing. And those are the two delusions which are cracked with the jhanas. The evidence is just too strong. You cannot maintain it anymore. In the same way you can't maintain the Buddha taught Abhidharma. Evidence is too strong when you look clearly enough. Same way that you aren't there. But that is another talk which may become the day after tomorrow. So don't go anywhere. You've got some great talks coming soon. Any comments or questions about that? Okay, next. Well, oh, this is a long one. Here we go. I'll answer this. At this time, sabbe sankhara dukkha, sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara anatta. When I see glimpses of this, what Buddha really meant, I got no choice other than to let go and get enlightened. After hearing what goes behind the walls in your monastery, especially during range retreat, monks getting jealous of each other, wanting to kick this one out and that one out, blah blah blah, wonder where is the best place to be if I want to renounce everything and to become a beggar. Do I have to be in a monastery to end this journey, or is it better to be a layperson and purify myself than be with monks who got a lot of sense of self and active defilements? Okay, in any monastery there are always some monks who are not perfect, but that's part of it, and don't think you're any different. Sometimes it's very easy to look at other people and say, oh, that person's got lots of defilements. But how many of you can look at yourself and say, wow, I'm as bad as that, but or maybe a bit better than that, doesn't matter. But the point is that a long time ago, there was an alien came from outer space, and they went to check out planet Earth. And they happened to go into a primary school, and they looked at these kids in grade one. Without them actually knowing that the aliens were looking, they checked them out all day and said, oh, this is interesting, what human beings are up to. And then they went back to their planet, and they came back again 20 years later, and they went to the same school, and they went into grade one, and the kids were still doing the same stuff. And I think, 20 years, these kids haven't learnt anything. Now, of course, you understand the mistake of those aliens. They'd visited, but they hadn't understood that actually people move through this whole system. And so if you go to a monastery, you'll find, if you go there today, you go there next year, you go there 2 years, 10 years, and actually you track every of those little monks who are there, you find actually over the years actually they do grow. Sure, there's always some scallywags there who are coming in grade one, but you can't judge them or complain, they're just grade one kids. What do you expect? But if you watch them over the years, they change. That's one of the great inspirations for me of being a monk for so long, to see how you take some of these raw materials. As one of the monks said, look, some of us, he said, have come straight out of the nightclub into this monastery. And he said, you know, we have got lust, we have got anger, we are sensuous, but give us a break, give us some time. And you actually see them over the years, and it's wonderful actually to see them actually becoming, you know, really inspiring good monks. So if you really want to see, you know, what a monastery like ours is, don't just judge it in one time. See how those monks who you saw this year, see what they're like next year and the year afterwards. And that gives you inspiration to see that people just like us, you know, jealous, you know, who doesn't like this person, wants that person, you know, that ordinary people, over the years, they become these great, great beings. And that's what the inspiration is. To see the change. And if you see that, you see that person who really obviously upset you and thought and you lost faith, see them in 5 years' time, see if they have changed. If they have changed, say, wow, this monastery works. Same as the nuns. Look at them now. If you can remember what they were like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and see what they're like in another 3 or 4 years' time. And then you can see if actually this practice actually does work. Yeah, indeed.
You're different 5 years ago.
That's right, yeah. I mean, because I've known a lot of you a long time, it's amazing just how much you've grown. I mean, in the Dhamma. In the Dhamma. Yeah. That's right, yeah. But many of those monks who misbehave, they later became great arahats. And it's wonderful actually to see that. To see how this path, if you keep on the path, actually leads somewhere. So it's, you know, it's nice actually to, you know, you tell stories about how stupid you were when you were a young monk and the silly things you did. And silly things other monks did. And you see that you change, you learn, and you grow. And that's wonderful to be able to see that. So that gives you the inspiration. Not what the monks are like now, but actually how they grow over the years.
There's a nice book written by Bhavanagar.
Oh, yes, yes.
His
that's right, yeah. He ran away for about 6 or 7 times. He was very, very naughty. And now he's this great monk. Yeah. I remember just recently getting a picture album. I think it was Ajahn Sumedho's 60th or 70th birthday or something. I got a picture of him when he was in the US Navy with a gun. This great monk. And you see, like a monk with a gun. That's really sort of weird. And, okay, I'll tell one of Ajahn Sumedho's stories. I remember being in Amrawati once, and he gave this, and it just, I was kidding myself laughing. Because he said when he was in the Navy, US Navy, I think he was during the Korean War time. Now, the ship docked in Osaka, I think. Not Osaka, but some of the ports in Japan. And it was R&R time. So, you know, many of you know Ajahn Sumedho. He's really pure-hearted, you know, this, you know, really good monk. And so he got into a rickshaw, and he couldn't speak Japanese. So where did the rickshaw driver take him? But to a brothel. So he went into the brothel, and there were the nuns who were listening to this, and they were killing themselves laughing. The very idea of this great monk going into a brothel. And then he said, but it's okay, because then these English sailors came in. And because the English are met, they're supposed to be allies, but actually when you're actually sailors, there's always a lot of jealousy. And one said one thing to the other, and there was going to be a fight, and he just left before there was a fight. He said, he really thanks those English sailors, if they didn't have a fight, you know, he'd have done something very naughty. He was a sailor, he wasn't a monk yet. So actually, when actually you see that these monks, they're ordinary human beings, they weren't born as monks, and then that gives you even more faith to see just how people actually grow. Okay, there's more to this thing. How do you handle situations like what happened during the Ranger Retreat when you've got unconditional love and kindness and you have to deal with monks with ego and active high level of defilements at the same time to protect the diligent practitioners? Again, you forgive a lot. You understand that, you know, you're dealing with a person who's growing, and you just actually contain it, make sure that, you know, no one does anything which is too gross, and give a lot of space for people to grow. The last thing you do is go criticizing or throwing people out. Because I've been in this business long enough to know that there's some, you know, young novices, and I thought these guys will never make it, they've got just too many defilements. But you know, they want to try, and so okay, as long as you want to try, you know, I'm going to support you, keep on going. And they keep on going and eventually become great monks or great nuns. So that's, you know, how I deal with that situation. You forgive, they're learning. And ask the lay community to forgive them as well. You know, people are learning. So don't expect all the monks to start off as being these perfect arahats, fully enlightened from the time they sort of start wearing the brown robe. They have to, you know, learn to live up to it. And eventually they do. Or they leave. But that's up to them. That's actually how I deal with that. You know, you've got to keep those basic rules. You can't go too far. You can't sort of go and kill each other. You know, I'll throw you out then. Or the police will, one of the two. But, you know, up to a point, you give people a lot of space. It's actually to learn. And what's your suggestion for someone who wants to become a monk or to get enlightened. Where is the place to live in peace? Not the Nullarbor Plain. Lots of the only place you can live in peace is in your own mind. Because if you can't be at peace here, you'll never be at peace in Bodhinyana Monastery or any monastery. If you're always trying to find the best monastery, you're like the dog with mange, the fault-finding mind, no place will be perfect for you. You go to the monk's monastery, that's not good enough. So you have a sex change and you go to the nun's monastery, that's not good enough. And you go to some other monastery, because you know, you take it with you. So most of the monasteries are more than good enough, especially our monasteries we have here in Perth. There's fabulous monasteries. So it's good enough. But if you have fault finding, you always find something wrong with everybody. Even people found something wrong with a Buddha. The most perfect person would always be criticized. That's why the Buddha once said, there's no one in this universe who is not a subject to both praise and criticism. You can't get one without the other. Yes?
When I was young, I lived in Thailand. We were so brought up to be more like a force, like a good lay person. And what it means by good lay person is that we learn how to support the Dhamma and learn how to, like, as you say, like not just in or something, but also like for example, like if you are female and then like you are young female or something like that, and then you go to a monastery and then there were young monks there, you were taught to be not kind, English and that sort of thing. So there was we always brought up there's a two way relationship, not just one way like the monk tell you what you are, the lay person tell you what to do, because that lay person needs to learn, so the monk needs to learn. And I remember very clearly that we brought up like that. And I start thinking maybe in Sri Lanka and other countries.
Yeah, it's true, but it's, you can imagine what it's like being a monk or being a nun. You know, you can see but not touch. You know, you can smell but you can't taste. So sometimes for young monks it's very difficult. You know, they will get lust coming up and they will get desire coming up. So this is why you've got to be careful and not to sort of overly excite the poor young monks. Or the poor young nuns as well. So be kind to them. But at the same time, that, you know, the monks, the nuns, have to live up, you know, to your generosity. And I make this quite plain to my monks, I made it plain to myself, that I live on your charity. The food I eat, you know, I don't earn, I don't buy it. It comes to me, and with it comes some expectation that I'm a good monk. So I always remember when I eat the food that this is not a freebie, it's responsibility. And if I can't, you know, be a good monk and inspire some people and do the duties, I shouldn't be eating your food. I remember that, and that makes me a good monk. So I'd also try and teach that to our monks as well. So if you're going to live in those huts and enjoy that food, at least you should be trying to do something and trying to make yourself a better person. I'm not going to judge you for who you are, but as long as you're moving in the direction of goodness and purity, then that's good enough. Okay. The story about there having been and will be other Buddhas is a bit hard to swallow. For example, was Kassapa Buddha really a human being on earth? The story seems awfully like what we know in this lifetime of earth, but that's not possible. Yeah, it's quite likely it could have been Kassapa the Buddha. I remember going off to the National Museum in India, and as in that National Museum, as well as these old Buddha relics, which are very fantastic, there's also a huge exhibition on the ancient Indus civilization of Harappa and Mohenjo-daro. And the reason I'm really fascinated by that is on the Indus Valley, it was pre-Aryan, so it was about the same time as Babylon civilization. It was a huge civilization. And they had such things as like channels for their water and irrigation and sewage. And what was fascinating there, that in the remains, all the roads were like on a grid, like New York, you know, perpendicular streets. And most anthropologists accept But you only get that sort of that grid system, that high organization, at a latter stage of a civilization's development. When civilizations start, you know, it's higgledy-piggledy, everybody for themselves. We need some organization there. And so many people actually suggest that those civilizations on the Andes and the Indus are incredibly old. Maybe even, you know, pre-Babylon. I'm really sort of upset at the Western archaeologists, because they always think that, you know, civilization started on the Euphrates and Tigris, and that sort of democracy started in Greece. It's very, very Western-centered. And as far as democracy is concerned, I mentioned this, I think, earlier, the Sangha, we follow a democratic model which was based on the Republic of Aranwesali, the Wajian Federation, and that was old in the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, which was before the time of Socrates. So at the very least, the Indian democracies were at the same time as the Greek democracies, and it's very likely they could have been pre-Greek. So the idea of democracy starting in Greece is very, very dubious. It's because, you know, Westerners are conceited and proud. You know, they want to own some of their history, and it's, you know, from there, not further east. And it's the same with those civilizations. They were incredibly old. And when I was there, I was just about 2 or 3 years ago, I was looking at the exhibit, and this Indian guy came up, and he said, "Ah, are you an archaeologist?" And I said, "No, I'm a monk." He said, "But I'm really fascinated." It was actually Professor Sharma, who was, you know, the head of the archaeological survey in India. He was in the Indian Museum at the time, so he had a really nice chat. He was the expert. And I remember telling him, he said, "You know, as far as I can see, I think these were, you know, much earlier than Babylon." And he got really excited. "Yes, yes, 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 no one believes me." And he was really my friend straight away afterwards. He invited me into his room for a cup of tea, but I said, I was busy, got lots of other people to look after. But, you know, he was actually agreeing that that civilization was very, very old. That could have been a place where a previous Buddha was, like Kassapa. So, the fact they say there's not, it couldn't have happened, I don't know, this human beings, you know, the Homo sapiens have been around, I don't know how long, but to think that there hasn't been some other organized civilizations before, well, Babylon or Greece, and that's really asking too much for us to believe. And there's archaeological evidence there. So, maybe there was Kassapa the Buddha before, in that Indus Valley. Anyway, we sometimes meet Buddhist meditators, lay people, who claim to be able to see past lives of them and others, all the way to the Buddha's time. Is this really possible? It's unlikely. Because when people start claiming these things, they usually say, very unlikely. Because what they're claiming it for is usually some ego or conceit. And most of the time, if people understand these things, they usually only tell their teacher. And I remember just giving a talk on reincarnation at the London Buddhist Vihara many years ago. And after giving the talk, that's about 20 years ago now, about 25 years ago, I think, I only had 7 rains then. And just afterwards, this little young man, he was about 16 or 17, came up. And he was one of the young men who was interviewed in Professor Ian Stevenson's book, I think 40 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And he told me, you know, when I was talking with him, he said, "You know, that's the worst thing I ever did, let on I was remembering my past lives." He said, "Because I was only a kid at the time, and it got publicity, and I caught hell in the playground. All the kids were teasing me no end about my old wife and your kids. Do you know what it's like in a playground as a kid? Anything which is slightly abnormal, and the other children pick on you." He said, "I had a terrible childhood because of that. I wish I'd never have done that." And when he said that, it made me very sort of clear that that guy obviously had his memories of the past life, because he'd never got anything out of that except a lot of trouble. And that's why many people just keep it quiet. Maybe they tell their teacher, but they don't broadcast it and tell everybody, "Yeah, this is who I was in my previous life." So people who go around broadcasting like that, it's very dubious. It's the same as anyone goes around and say, "Look at me, I'm enlightened." Because, you know, what you're doing that for is a stupid thing to say. So it can be done, and maybe the day after tomorrow, No, maybe with jhanas, I might sort of talk about how you can remember your past lives. But if you do, don't tell too many people. You get into big trouble. I used to think one needs guidance to progress through deep meditation, i.e. to go on to the next step. But from what I am hearing now, it seems one can go in and in towards, all the way towards enlightenment. Is, by oneself, is this right? You can go so far, but people usually get lost. And they're not quite sure where they are, and they don't know what's going on. So a lot of times when I've been teaching these jhanas, many people have came up and said, that's amazing, that happened to me a long time ago, I never knew what it was. Thank you. Because sometimes you need to be taught to actually to find out what's going on so you can take it further, you can make sense of it. So it is good to get guidance, and that's why that monks like me teach, why I do write books, so people can actually understand exactly what's going on. Otherwise it's too much hit and miss. Sure, you can do it, but it's unlikely. If you get some guidance, you're increasing the possibilities. But more than that, and I mention this again when I'm talking about the deeper insights about enlightenment, that having the jhanas themselves is not going to make you enlightened. There's another factor needed, and that's some words of another to tell you what it means, to guide you. You need the map, the framework. So you've got that experience. You need some help to understand what it means. Because they say, and this is so true, that to become enlightened you need those deep experiences, but also the words of another. Of another person who's been enlightened. Otherwise, you get the jhanas, but you can very easily mistake them for something they're not. Okay, next question. I did this already. Sense desire is my biggest problem. I did that one already. Maybe what these ones yesterday's? Oh yes, so these are yesterday's questions. Yup. So I think we're finished. The questions. Yeah, that one's this question is relevant. It is thought that in the past some Catholic meditators got into jhanas, but their perceptions were different given that jhanas should lead to truth. Could you please comment? Yeah, it's with some of the Catholic mystics, people like St. Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross. Now, Teresa of Avila used to levitate, and that was actually, many people saw that. And it's they said that, well, it's quite clear from what I read, or not actually clear, but it's very suggestive that they got into jhanas, and they thought that was union with God. And if you ever get a jhana, you can understand why that's an easy mistake to make. There's union there, it's one pointedness, there's no duality, you know, you're right in the center of things and you can't move out. Your idea of a self is completely being abandoned, you know, it's not like a normal you. And you're merging this incredible, powerful energy of bliss. And of course people will think that is God. The most amazing experience. You're just one with this power. And first jhana will feel like that. So I can understand how if you came from a Christian background and you got into first jhana, it'll be union with God. And you'll be in line to be the next saint. They'll be building churches after you with your name on it. You know, the church of Dr. Banda. Or whatever. The church of you. And the point is that as a Buddhist, actually, you know that that's not union with God, it's something more than that, but it's very, very powerful. And it's because, you know, you have a bigger framework, because the Buddha knew those jhanas and knew much more, that you can actually take it further and get into enlightenment. So, yeah, I think that they did. Get those jhanas, but I don't think they understood exactly what they were. And they probably just got the first jhana, no deeper than that. Actually, there are some new questions here. I'll just do a couple more. If jhana is crucial for an enlightenment experience, how did monks, nuns and lay people become enlightened when the Buddha was giving his Dharma discourse? Also, Ananda became enlightened when he was just about to put his head to the pillow, and not because he just came out of jhana. Why is that? They had the jhana experiences before. So at that time, whenever you've got a jhana experience, you don't get enlightened always just after sometimes it's days after, because you recall that experience. Now you've got the data. And once you've got the data, you have the means to understand, you know, what the Buddha was talking about. It doesn't happen automatically just after jhana, sometimes days after, weeks after, but you've got that jhana there, you know exactly what it is. And you've got the new way of looking. And also you do need to have the hindrances disappear and the experience of a jhana to be able to come enlightened. So Ananda, he had his jhanas. That's why Ananda actually, after the Buddha passed away, they said, somebody asked him, it was Dasaka, the householder. And they asked him, Ananda said, how did the Buddha say you should become enlightened? What was the method? What is the way? And Ananda said, there was 11 ways to become enlightened. And only those 11. And one is through first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, or fourth jhanas. The next four were the Brahmavihara jhanas, through metta jhana, mudita, karuna, and upeka. And the next three were the three immaterial attainments of the base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, and nothingness. He said those are the only ways you can get into enlightenment. That's Ananda speaking, and he just become enlightened based on the jhanas, or the immaterial jhanas, or the jhanas which come around through metta, or karuna, upeka, and mudita. So you do need jhanas. Does that answer the question? Could you please explain how anumodana works? I did that one. Some I've done before, some I haven't. Please explain what is vipassana meditation. Is it called insight meditation, which is unique to Buddhism? Okay, vipassana meditation is sometimes called insight meditation. It's basically come out of the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition of Burma. It is loosely based on commentaries, but it was basically started by Mahasi Sayadaw. And the vipassana meditation, the original vipassana, was always alongside samatha. In the suttas and the time of the Buddha, there was no difference. So that's been separated afterwards by monks who came much later. It's called insight meditation, and they claimed it was the only way to enlightenment, but when you look at it, that is not tenable. You can't say that. The only way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. It's just like being conceited and unique. And also they said it was unique to Buddhism, which again is really wrong. What is unique to Buddhism is the jhanas. I mentioned that in my book. In the suttas, it never says that the Buddha discovered vipassana. But it does say twice the Buddha discovered jhanas. In the Sanghita Nikaya and also in the Panchalandana Sutta in the Anguttara. It actually says the Buddha discovered the jhanas. So the jhanas are unique, but don't say jhanas are unique. The Eightfold Path is what's unique to Buddhism, the full path.
What does it mean when he says he discovered it?
Because he found it.
But he had the first jhana when he was a little boy.
He did have it when he was a little boy, but no one else had it. So he actually discovered it. Past life, yes, but there was no jhanas being done in that time. That's why I mentioned yesterday in the Subha Sutta, there the Buddha says, I can't see any samasamadhi, any jhanas, being perfected in any other tradition except mine. It's in Subha
Sutta.
Subha Sutta, number 10 of Digha Nikaya.
Yes, can I ask you what the general history of meditation seems to be? It disappeared for some time, didn't it?
No, the meditation was always there. And there was always monks and nuns who actually, from teacher to teacher, would always be meditating, getting to the jhanas, getting enlightened. And even in our time, you know, whether you're in Sri Lanka or whether you're in Thailand or Burma, there was always these monks who were off in the forest getting into their jhanas. I know that the Thai tradition, again, I'm challenging a lot here. A lot of people say the forest tradition was started again by Ajahn Mun. But that's actually just one tradition, just blowing their own trumpet. But many other forest monks, which were before Ajahn Mun, at the same time as Ajahn Mun, after Ajahn Mun, you know, living in the forest, meditating, getting into their jhanas. It's an unbroken tradition.
Do you need jhanas to realize you're not self?
Yes, you need jhanas to realize not self. It doesn't seem like it. All the practices before, obviously in the time of Kassapa the Buddha there was. So, but I mean, by the time the Buddha was born, completely disappeared, died out. There may have been people sitting reasonably still, maybe sort of contemplating things, but no jhanas.
But then, in Varanasi, there are Lord Buddha gave the first.
Yes.
It's called Isipatana, because the sheets used to come and what
the taught. Yes, I know, but the Rishis, I've seen some Rishis in my life, the people who've been in caves. There's one Rishi, Receding Dawn, he's a Thai Rishi, and he was in the neighborhood of our monastery, so they came to visit. Had his long hair, big wild eyes. He was crazy. He was been in a sort of a cave for about 10 or 15 years. He was completely out of his mind. But it was so weird and strange that people loved seeing Rishis, because a lot of times we have got no discernment. Anything weird and strange you think is holy.
The name of the place is
Isipatana. But sometimes they
can. Yeah.
Rishis, yeah. But exactly what those Rishis were, and whether it really was that in the time of the Buddha or.
And the monk, there I explained that so many monks, Rishis.
It could have been the times past, but not the time of the Buddha, because there was no Rishis around in those days. It doesn't seem to be. Anyway, no one is practicing anything, because the whole of the practice of that time was on sacrifice, or the Jainas doing ascetic practices. And the actual practice of meditation, especially the practice of jhanas, which needed this soft mind, I think you've got the message so far during this retreat, you need a very, very soft mind to get into a jhana, and a mind of letting go, not a mind of control and force. And when the Buddha understood that, then he stopped all this harshness, and when his five friends saw him abandoning all these harsh practices, not being so tough, they left in disgust. They thought Gotama had forgotten the practice, he was just reverting to luxury, just becoming a layperson again. And they left him. And it's only the Buddha realized that that is what's needed to get into the jhanas. Even his five friends couldn't understand that. And that's why the middle path, you know, avoiding the extremes, not literally getting up too early, not forcing the body, not forcing the mind, but you know, working with it kindly, gently, compassionately. That's what the middle path means. And that's what the Buddha discovered, which is very, very difficult, because either people got into too much toughness and asceticism, or they got into just indulgence. And this thing in between, as you found even in this retreat, is very, very hard. To be soft, to trust the path, not indulge, but not be strict. That's the middle path. And if you do it correctly, that does lead to the jhanas. Because that wasn't recognized as a valid path in the time of the Buddha, his five friends, they just abandoned him. So he had to reteach his friends exactly what the path was. He discovered the path and also the result.
So then the story about this, actually his first story about a young woman telling his teacher he will have the violin not to type, not to...
Oh yes, right, you're right.
And Buddha heard that, one Buddha before he became Buddha. Siddhartha Bonham heard that while he was meditating, and so he went in that direction or something.
Yeah, now that's not the full story. The full story is actually was Sona. He was one of the monks in the time of the Buddha. And he was actually working too hard. And then they gave him the simile of the lute. You know, not sort of trying too hard, not trying too slack, but just when you just get it right, the right effort, then you know it's the right effort. You know it's the strings are just tight enough because of the sound it makes.
Yes.
But that's actually a story from after the Buddha's enlightenment. So what you heard there was a commentary which came much later.
The original sutra says Devadatta had jhanas, or is it
something it did say he had jhanas, yes. So you can have jhanas and not become enlightened, yes.
Yeah, but how
someone goes so wrong to the other tradition?
Ah, because jhanas is not enough, but it's necessary to have those jhanas. It's unlikely, but what happens there is pride. Look at me, I've got... Sorry? It's letting go, but you get those jhanas afterwards, and then afterwards you see, wow, look, I've got these jhanas. And it wasn't so much the jhanas he was proud of, it was the psychic powers which came as a result. And remember, the fellow had jealousy towards the Buddha all his life. They were cousins together. And so that jealousy for all the life was just latent there, and unfortunately the jhanas didn't eradicate that. And once he had jhanas, look at me. As soon as he started focusing on his jealousy and on his pride and his psychic powers, he lost them all. Which is why that if you don't keep precepts, if you don't keep your virtue, the psychic powers, they can arise and they can disappear again. And there's been many, many cases of like gurus and holy people, like, you know, somebody told me that Sai Baba had a video taken of him saying he was cheating. And you know, what's happening there? Because I've heard lots of stories of like holy people.
He was shown in New Zealand.
Yes.
And I saw it.
Yeah.
On TV. But everything he's done.
Yeah, but the point is, he wouldn't have been able to do that at the very beginning. And I think usually what happens that these beings, they have got the real psychic powers to begin with. You know, because they're pure beings, but they get into pride or they get into look at me. And they lose them. And I don't know why that is, but they usually tend to manufacture them and cheat later on to keep up their egos, yeah. But I think it's a strange thing. They seem to, from what I know, they have their psychic powers in the beginning when they're young. And they lose them, and then they start to cheat just to keep up the appearances later on. It seems to be that way. That's my hypothesis. And with that Devadatta, he couldn't even fake them afterwards. Okay, I think that's 9:30. So, we almost got through all the questions. There's a few left, but we will do those tomorrow. So, remember, don't think too much whether Devadatta had the jhanas or not. Now you are here, you can put aside all of those thoughts. And you get the jhanas yourself, and then you'll understand whether Devadatta had those jhanas or not, and whether they are necessary for enlightenment or not. Because you should always challenge and never believe what I say, but find out for yourself. If jhanas are necessary or not, at least they're very useful. That's how the Buddha became enlightened, and he always praised them. He said, develop them. So, now you have the time. The night is still young.
Is it not true to say that jhana is the beginning? Like a degree, I mean, you get a degree and that's the beginning.
I think I call it like almost like the pivot point. Like, I know in English now, ever since George Bush, the last year in his troubles in Iraq, he always started calling this tipping point. We have like tipping point in global war, tipping point in the civil war in Iraq, and tipping point in economies. So it's a current word. So I call jhanas a tipping point. When you get that tipping point, then you're off into enlightenment. Or at least you know you're damn close. So the tipping point. Okay, so if you haven't got a tipping point now, you might as well tip yourself into bed. Waste of time. And I might see you in the morning if conditions are right. So good night, have a nice sleep.